That was almost a humble introduction. Jesus. I'm Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain sponsorable and a persistent and consistent effort in our primary purpose of trying to forget ourselves and help other drunks. And because of all of that, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. And that's unbelievable for me. I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank Ken, who's been a great host, and Lee for inviting me down here. And the other speakers and old friends are here, like Jerry and John. John's got the headphones on. He's actually listening to an old talk of himself. So you'll see him laugh when there's nothing funny occasionally because he's listening to himself. And my dear friend Kent and Scott and Linda, and I'm delighted to be here. I got excited when I pulled up here and I saw the Ray Charles Memorial. I'm a music guy. I grew up on Ray Charles. I got to see him live at Caesar's Palace many years ago, and I'll never forget the episode of Saturday Night Live when he hosted it, and it opens and it's him sitting at the piano, and you can't see anything else, just a spotlight, Ray at the piano. And he gives this little spiel about, you know, they've been bugging him for a couple of years to host Saturday Night Live, and he wouldn't do it. And they bugged him about it. He finally said, I agreed to do it only if they would move it out of that crappy studio and into Carnegie Hall. So he said, so live from Carnegie Hall, Saturday Night Live, and the lights go up in the same old studio. What a sense. You know, he knew what was going on. That's amazing to me, right? I'd like to welcome the new people. I'm glad you're here. Especially the people that came up and got the books. I mean, for God's sakes, where else on the planet will you get a prize and a standing ovation for recently burning your life to the ground? I mean, not going to get that anywhere else, man. I'm telling you. Jeez. I'd like to welcome anybody else that's new. In case you're just coming out of the fog, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. That might make some of you go, oh, no. Hasn't come to that, has it? Yeah, well, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're glad you're here. Because we know things about you that you don't know. We know what can happen to you here, and it's spectacular. If you'll get out of the group, and especially if you've been a relapser, if you can get out of the group that it talks about in Chapter 5 who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program and be part of the group that does, your life will change so dramatically. And we know some things about you and that you don't know. You'll know after we tell you, but you don't know. And first, we know you've had a bad year. Yeah, no. We know it hasn't been good. You've had problems with money and people and relationships. And you've been worrying about yourself a lot lately, haven't you? Yeah. And we know that because that's us. Because that's how we all get here. Nobody gets here on a good streak, and I'm glad you're here, and I hope that you might hear something tonight or see something this weekend or hear something from one of the other speakers, not to enlighten you. We don't stay sober on profundities. We stay sober on finding the spark necessary to take the actions. And maybe you'll hear something this weekend that will get you to do something and do things you were never too willing to do before. And your life will change. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. Jesus. That's funny, but that's really true. I don't plan and nothing. I don't write nothing down. I just pray like hell, and then I think in the prayers and meditation, I think about the new people, and even more importantly, in this day and age, I think about the people that are sober 20 years, and you're in a lot of trouble. And you may go like some of my friends have gone over the years, nice people have taken their own life with many, many years of sobriety. Because you know you can't drink, it makes it worse. And yet you can't stand where you're at anymore. And you're so desperate for relief that suicide starts looking like a good deal. And I'm here to talk to you. Because you can turn that around. And I don't know why I ended up an alcoholic. I was confused about that because my mother and father weren't alcoholics. They were just wonderful people. Good people. They loved me, and I punished them for that for years. And I shouldn't have been an alcoholic, except that there was something wrong with me. And it was wrong with me before I ever picked up a drink, but that the things that were wrong with me don't necessarily make me an alcoholic. There's a lot of neurotic, self-involved people in the world, but some of them can drink. But when I brought that to the table, all these feelings of not fitting and this worrying mind and this depressive nature and this lonely separateness that I always seem to suffer from. When I brought that to the table with alcohol, alcohol did something for me and something to me that it only does for and to alcoholics. And the first thing that was evident to me is what it did for me, and it was spectacular. I love the effect of alcohol. I mean, there was nothing better than that. I love what Wilson says in his story. He says, I was a part of life at last. I'm hanging around with these older kids, and these are the tough kids. I'm like almost 13 years old. These kids are 15, 16. They're in and out of juvie all the time. These are the kids that when they walk into a junior high dance, the other kids get out of the way. And when you're secretly afraid and feel weak and pathetic and you don't fit anywhere, man, I want to fit with those guys. Because maybe some of their something's going to rub off on some of my nothing. And up until the time I had my first drink, I was like a pretend person. I was the guy that it talks about in Into Action that creates the double life. I had a stage character. And the problem with that is it's killing me. I cower behind the facade, afraid someone's going to find out. And I took that, I drank that whiskey for the first time. And my God, it's like it set me free. My parents had always, I had a high IQ, and they were always talking to me about my potential. I never knew what that was. I knew what it was that day. I found my potential. And it was spectacular, man. I'm telling you. Oh, I went from the guy who's coming from behind, who's phony, who doesn't really fit with these guys, awkward with these guys, afraid. I went from that guy to their leader. I went from subnormal to supernormal. It was all of a sudden I could come out and play. I could talk to them. I was funny. I'm not funny. I'm a mope. I'm a depressive mope. You get me half drunk, I'm funny. I crack me up. I am funny. I used to hang around with a bunch of juvenile delinquents down at this pool hall, and I'm never that good shooting pool sober, but I'd get sort of in that zone. Just drunk, but not drunk. That came later that day. But just there's a little window, and you get in that little window, and I couldn't miss. I blow my own mind. I could talk to girls. I can't talk to girls. And I don't want to be crude, but the truth is, if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd probably be celibate to this day. I mean, I could never hook that up. I was too self-conscious. I was too afraid, man. I would rather reject myself than face the reality of it out here. And alcohol set me free. It
Oh my God, it made me smarter and more creative. Do you ever have the experience about 3 a.m., drinking some wine, smoking a little reefer, with your buddies cracking the secrets of the universe, you know, just getting in that deep stuff, that deep. I remember saying to my buddies one time, I think this is what Buddha saw. You know what I mean? See the big picture. And then you know what happens. I sober up and I'm back to being me again. And I got my big secret is I never liked that much. You know, the first time I ever experienced the effect of alcohol, it's like I didn't know that I didn't really feel good until I really felt good. And then I lived for it. I thought, this is amazing. I love this. And I didn't understand what alcohol did for me. I understand exactly what it did for me today. It relieved me of the bondage of self. And with the bondage of self went my worrying mind, my feelings of anxious apartness, and my depressive nature, which are all symptomatic of a superly self-involved guy. Because I don't know about you guys, when I'm really self-involved, things are serious and heavy. I just get me right here, you know, I can't get me off of me. And I just feel like I can't breathe. Because I'm smothering myself. With this obsessive self-involvement. And alcohol relieved me of the bondage of self, and it was spectacular. And it's a new freedom and a new happiness. It's amazing. I loved it. Well, I got alcoholism, and I don't know I have alcoholism. And if you have alcoholism, in the beginning, alcohol does something for you, but it also does something to you, and it always did this thing to me, and yet I couldn't see it for years. It was probably 4 or 5 treatment centers and many, many failures at trying to control and enjoy my drinking before I could see the truth. And it was a truth that, be honest with you, I didn't want to see. And I didn't want to see that I have alcoholism. When it says in the beginning of chapter 3, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. Oh, man. I went to great lengths not to be alcoholic. I'll be anything other than alcoholic. I'll be a drug addict. I mean, I had rock star professed heroes that were drug addicts. That's kind of sexy and has panache to it. I'm good with that. I'll be a mental health case, because if you're a mental health case, you get pills and sympathy. I like both of those. I'm good with all that. But I don't want to be an alcoholic. I had some uncles who were alcoholics, and man, they were pathetic and obnoxious, and I don't understand alcoholism, but I know people that have the alcoholic label are people nobody cares for. And I don't want to be an alcoholic. But I have alcoholism, and people who argue with the truth get sick. And in arguing with the reality of my alcoholism and trying to stick it on other things, I got sicker and sicker. My mother, who loved me, my mother was a therapist. She worked for MHMR in Pennsylvania. And because she was a therapist, she got me in to see some great psychiatrists. I mean, some of the best of the best. I identify with Roland Hazard going to Jung. Like, Jung was the best at that time. And but the more I tried to figure me out, the more lost I became. Isn't that odd that I could spend, my family could spend thousands and thousands of dollars on psychiatrists, and I'm studying myself deeply, and the more I try to figure me out, the more confused I am, and these learned men with multiple doctorate degrees can't help me. I'm getting worse as a result of them, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and car salesmen and plumbers and stuff start talking about themselves, and I start finding myself. In a way I couldn't find in therapy. As I listened to you, I came alive. You know, in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, there's a poem in there that I really like a lot. And it kind of describes how I came here. And it says, he who knows not and knows not that he knows not is a fool. Shun him. He who knows not and knows that he knows not is a child. teach him. He who knows, but knows not that he knows, is asleep. Wake him. And he who knows and knows that he knows is wise. Follow him. And I remember sitting in the detox as my first sponsor started to share about his alcoholism. He wasn't talking about me. He's talking about him. And I just sat there and started nodding my head. And I'm starting to make those connections. And I'm starting to find my lost self in your experience. And I know what's behind the curtain. You know, in our second tradition, it talks about something that's very sacred in Alcoholics Anonymous. This ultimate authority and how it expresses itself through this group conscience. When we come together for the purpose of recovery, I'm telling you, there's something in the midst. That's great. The sum is greater than the parts. I go to my home group. I get there an hour, hour and a half early, and I stand at the door and I start greeting. Because I like to feel the energy of the 300 or so people that come in there build. Until there's a spirit in the room you can cut with a knife. And it's enthusiasm. It's enthusiasm for a life that had one time been depressing and fearful and boring and lonely. Lonely. And that's all. And the enthusiasm is not only for individuals that have had a transformation, but for the newer people who have the opportunity placed in front of them to get free. Free from the bondage of self. Well, I got alcoholism and it does something to me that I don't know. And that's what it is every time I pick up a drink, something happens to me that only happens to alcoholics. As I feel the effect of the alcohol, I break out in an irresistible yearning for more. I've never not had that happen. I was 10 years sober, probably, or close to it. And I was sitting in a meeting, and there was somebody talking about drinking for a while socially and crossing over this invisible line, right? And I thought, well, maybe I did that in the beginning. I was searching, you know, because you'd think, wouldn't you? You'd think that there must have been a couple occasions where maybe I was in some guy's basement doing lines, smoking a little reefer, drinking wine, or maybe like I like to hang out at the bar and do shots and beers with my buddies and shoot pool. Was there ever a time after drinking for an hour where someone said, hey, Bob, can I buy you another one? I'm looking for the one time where I said to them, you know, I'm good here, thanks. There's not one time, not one. You'd think there'd be one. Not one. Not one. My daughter, I love my daughter. My daughter is such a... She's a spiritual giant on the natch. I mean, there was one point she was giving me a relationship advice because that's my Achilles heel. And I started thinking, boy, she should sponsor me, man. She's amazing. And she's not alcoholic. And she calls me up a couple years ago and she's in a little bit of a panic on the phone. And she said, oh, Dad, I almost got a DUI. I said, Kate, I didn't think you drank that much. He said, well, I don't really, Dad, but I was out at Stoney's, and Stoney's is a bar where my daughter socializes with she has a lot of friends, they go there and they dance, they do the line dances. She says, I was in Stoney's about 6 hours, and I came out and got in my car, and I was on my cell phone, a cop saw it, and he pulled over, and he gave me a field sobriety test, and she had just become a manager of this bank. And she said, Dad, I was scared to death. I could lose everything. I said, for God's sakes, Kate, what happened? She said, well, I blew a little bit less than a .05. You were in a bar for 6 hours. And you blew less than .0. I'd blow a 1.5 to get the courage to go in a bar. You know what I'm saying, right? I mean, but just to drive my car, I'm too stiff and uptight. Oh, God. But see, when my daughter drinks, as the effect hits her, she just kind of puts the brakes on. She likes a little bit of it, I suppose, but not much. Not much. because she doesn't have what I got. But when I get to the same part, the same place inside of me where she puts the brakes on, I have a really different reaction to alcohol. Where she goes, whoa, I go, yeah. I mean, I'm just getting lit, man. And I can't, I have to have that. I have to have more. I have to have more. I was a guy, if I was at your house and we're drinking, especially in Pennsylvania, it's Sundays. You can't get nothing. Now, well, I think that's changed. But back in the day, and if we were drinking and we drink it all up and there's no more, oh, my God, I'd be on like a panic. You know what I'd do? Because of an allergic reaction to alcohol, I'm going to go to your bathroom and go through your medicine cabinet. And I'll just start taking stuff. Half the time, I don't even care what I'm taking. If the bottle says, don't operate heavy machinery, I get excited. If it says it may cause sleeplessness, I get excited in a different way. I mean, I took some stuff that had me up for a day and a half with plans to change the world. You know, I mean, oh, yeah, excited. Just, oh, we're going to. I took some, I think it was phenobarbital. It made my legs like rubber. I was like falling around. One time I got really regular. Oh, geez. I took all the pills off one of those wheels and found out later, no chance I'll be pregnant in my lifetime. And why is that? Is it because I'm a pill head? No, it's because I'm an alcoholic, and I was drinking alcohol, and it set that thing off inside of me that demanded attention, demanded it. But I don't know that I have that. And I think a couple people this weekend had mentioned this weird dynamic of how you can't see the phenomenon of craving because of the way it uses your own mind against you. I had many occasions where I was in trouble. I was a blackout drinker, so I got in trouble. Any blackout drinkers in here? It's hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do, isn't it? Yeah, you know, it's really. And I don't know about you guys. I never did anything good in a blackout. Nobody ever came up to me and said, oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. I'd hear things like, you peed in our kitchen. You threw up in my living room. You hit on my wife. You stole my stash. You passed out my front lawn. The absolute worst when I was sick. I was shaking. I needed a drink bad. And a guy cut into me before I get to that state liquor store and said, you know you told everybody last night you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match. Oh, I want to shoot myself, right? And what's happening is now I'm drinking over my drinking, which is like a perpetual motion machine. And I'm filling up with shame and remorse and self-loathing, which makes abstinence more unobtainable because when I'm sober, I'm conscious and in the presence of the guy I hate the most. Which shouldn't be a mystery, but it was kind of. I went to therapy trying to deal with that. But what I'm missing the point of it. I should have hated myself. For God's sakes, if someone else would have done to my loved ones what I did to them, I'd want to kill them. Of course I loathe myself. Of course I do. Cause and effect. But I don't know any of that stuff. And so I had this one night in particular, I had several like this where I went into a blackout and I did some horrible things, and you know, it's just kind of like snapshots. Sometimes blackouts are a blessing because you do stuff and you're better off not knowing what that was. But I got snapshots, and a friend who's a non-alcoholic, and these people drive me crazy. There's people who just live to tell you what you did the night before. You know what I mean? And they're laying stuff. This guy's laying stuff on me, and I'm cringing. And I'm horrified, and I'm so full of shame, and I'm talking to myself, and I'm saying, man, I can't do that anymore. I could have went to prison. I can't do that anymore, for God, this is disgusting. But I'm supposed to meet my buddies at the bar. Now, I don't want to take drinking off the table. I mean, that would be overreacting. and I'm nervous and I'm hungover and I need a drink, but I don't want to do what I did the night before. So I come up with a plan. I'm a good plan maker. And the plan is I'm going to just go to meet my buddies and shoot some pool. And I'll have 8 drinks. 8's a good number. I never punched a cop on 8 drinks or did anything too bizarre on 8 drinks. That's somewhere north of 12. 8's a good number. I feel confident with 8. I feel secure with 8. I feel like I'm going to have a nice buzz. I'm going to have some fun. I'm going to meet my friends. We're going to shoot some pool. I'm going to get loose. Nice. 8 drinks. Good plan. You go to the bar, and if any of you have ever tried that, there's a funny phenomenon that happens when you get to 7. All of a sudden, you realize 8's a bad number. You know, and as other speakers had said this weekend, I don't think it's an allergic reaction to alcohol. I think I just changed my mind. I think I got new information. Right? I didn't realize this much fun was going on at the bar. And I didn't know that. And what happened to me is I lived the progression of this disease, and it's a horrible thing. Because the only thing that meant anything to me was the effect of alcohol and that feeling. And as the years went on, I started to get more and more trouble. And as the trouble increased, the effect and the magic diminished. And it seemed to bleed out. And I didn't understand what was happening to me. And now I'm at the very end of my drinking. It was pathetic. I would drink in deep depression. I would drink in heartbreaking loneliness that would drive me crazy at times. I mean, I might be on your telephone at 3 in the morning calling up ex-girlfriends and crying into the phone until her husband gets on and threatens me. Or just calling anybody. I would call suicide hotline. I think I called AA a couple times. I don't know. But I would just be so lonely. And I don't know what happened to me, because alcohol was a cure for that at one time. I mean, in the early days of my drinking, alcohol was spiritual. I mean, I could walk into a party or a club or a bar and just have me right up on me, man. And I am just disconnected from life. I'm depressed. I feel horrible. And that loneliness, that Wilson, I love the way Wilson explains it. He says it's a state of anxious apartness. Oh boy. We all know that. It's that feeling, it's all of you and then there's me. That anxious apart. I hated that. And I could walk into a bar or a club and I can't even talk to anybody. I just glare at everybody. I just hate everybody in there. And after about 7 or 8 drinks, we're planning our vacations together, and I mean, oh my God, these are my people. 15 drinks, I'm saying things like, I love you, bro, you know, I'll die for you, man, you know. I couldn't stand them as I walked in. Because alcohol did something for me that I so, so desperately needed to have done. Well, as the years go on and the problems increase, I'm hurting a lot of people. My mother and father spent a fortune on psychiatrists and treatment centers. They put me in one treatment center that what it cost them, you could have bought a 3-bedroom house in a nice neighborhood for what it cost them in that one treatment center. And the more they helped me, the worse I got. And I broke their heart. And one of the worst things I used to do is I'm sincere when I would hit a bottom and I would tell them I'm sorry. I would be sincere. And I'm going to turn around. I'm going to turn this around. And I'm going to get on my feet. And they would spend money to send me back to college. Or my dad had helped me get a good job or something like that. They'd always were there for me because they loved me. And every time I'd get back on my feet, and they get their hopes up and they'd start to relax a little bit. That's the time where I'd burn my life to the ground and I'd steal from them and disappoint them and break their hearts again. I stole so much from my dad, he became friends with a guy who owned a pawn shop in the town we lived in. True story. And they finally, I remember I was in a hospital. I had a broken rib. I don't even know how I got it. I used to get hurt a lot, and I don't know how I, you know, get blackouts, right? I had a broken rib, very painful. And I was on IVs because I was dehydrated. I was just drinking that cheap wine. I was a mess. I had the sores, and you know how you do when you don't eat and you drink that cheap wine, and it's bad. And my parents come in and they asked me for my house key back, and they told me, don't ever come around our house again or we'll have you arrested, and do not call us. You're dead to us. And I couldn't believe it. And here's the weird thing. Later that year, I ended up in jail, and my dad had the ability to pick up the phone and get me out on bail. I called him up, and he hung up on me. And man, I was pissed. I was hot. So I wrote my mother this letter from jail. And in the letter, I pulled out all the stops. In the letter, I said, I know you don't want to help me anymore. I've disappointed you so much, but I know you tried to love me, and I'm just so sick, and I'm sorry I've been a bad son, and I want you to go on with your life and don't worry about me. Last night I was raped by a bunch of guys, and I'm gonna hang myself, but that's okay. I love you, and don't worry about me. And they still wouldn't bail me out. Oh my God! I was fuming. Oh, he still hung up on me again, man. I tell you, that I tried to make amends for that letter after I got sober. They did not want to talk about that letter. We forgive you, but let's not. I don't want to go there. Right. They cut me out of their life physically, but I found out from my sister they couldn't cut me out of their heart. And my mother now was seeing her own therapist and taking medication. And my father slept 15 hours a day, 16 hours a day. He was in, I guess, kind of a depression over it. They never left the house the last couple years I was out there. And they had once, my dad had been president of the Lions Club, and they were involved in the country club, the YR club. My mother was junior league, women's club. They did all these charity drives. They were very community oriented and very connected. The last 3 years, they never left the house because they were just tired of people asking them questions about me. And I'd have gone around and tell anybody that would listen to me how I'd never hurt anybody except myself. What a selfish perspective. And I'm dying on the inside, and I can't. And the worst thing about this disease, I'll tell you, it's not the consequences. I have a sick ability to roll with them. I mean, I do. As long as I can get high, man, and it works for me, I don't care. I get in my crazy mind, if I could have got high like I got high when I was 16 years old, in exchange for that, I'd be willing to spend 6 months of every year in jail. It would seem like a good deal to me, because that's all I cared about. But when the worst thing about this disease is once you've burnt your life to the ground and you hate yourself and there's nothing worth living for, and When you need the effect of alcohol the most, it pulls the plug on you. And the last couple of years, I drank in horrible depression. It was bad. In 1977, I ended up in an emergency room. I hurt myself again. That just happens sometimes. And I had to get stitches. And they x-rayed me. And so I've been in this hospital for a couple hours. And they do not have bars in emergency room waiting rooms. If they ever needed a bar somewhere, they need one there, I'm telling you. So I'm sobering up, not by choice, but just by time. And I'm sitting in this waiting room, and I got to wait. They want me to wait for the results of these x-rays. And there's a rack of medical pamphlets there. And I... you know, like heart disease and diabetes and different things. And there was this one caught my attention. It was something like 7 warning signs of cancer. Well, it got my attention. I grabbed it. I started leafing through it. And one of the things it talked about in there that was supposedly a warning sign of cancer was unexplained intermittent bleeding. And I remember reading that thinking, oh my God, you know, there are times when I'm dry heaving my guts up and blood comes out. Matter of fact, oh, there's been a few times I've been bleeding out of both ends. And I thought, oh my God, I got terminal cancer. Oh my God. And then it was like an epiphany. I thought, oh, it's metastasized to my brain. Well, it explained my whole life. I mean, now I know why I do bizarre things and can't remember them. Now I know why I'll fly off the handle at someone and just start screaming, yelling at them. Why I get angry and why I get these emotional inappropriate. Why nobody likes me. Why everybody's pulled away from me. I have a brain tumor. Oh, man. And I'd sit and I'd drink those bottles of Richard's Wild Irish Rose and I'd think about that brain tumor. Sometimes I could feel it growing in there. And I'd think about, you know, one of these days they're going to take me to the hospital and they're going to find out that I'm terminally ill with a brain tumor. They're going to put me in probably a cancer ward, I guess. And of course, they're going to have to notify my mother and father, who will have nothing to do with me because they think I'm a degenerate bum. And they're going to realize how wrong they had been about me. And they're going to come running to the hospital. They'll probably put me back in their will. It'll be amazing. They'll start taking care of me again. It's great. Then, of course, all my ex-girlfriends are going to be notified. They all thought I was a bum, and they'll come rushing to the hospital, properly ashamed of themselves. And I just like sitting up thinking about that brain tumor. And, well, then I ended up another detox. And they're interviewing me, and you know how the medical people do in those places. They check your vitals and stuff. And I said to this medical guy, I said, listen, doc, I got a terminal brain tumor. And he looks at me, and he goes, really? Has that been verified? I said, yes, it has. Well, it was verified by the smartest guy on the planet, me. And so he gets excited. He set me up with a whole bunch of tests. They shot dye in me, put me in a tube, blood work, all kinds of stuff. And I'm waiting for redemption, where everybody's going to realize how wrong they've been about Bob. And he calls me in, and I'm excited. I want to hear about the brain tumor. And he calls me in, and he said, you know, you don't have a brain tumor. You don't have cancer at all. The only thing we could find was a small ulcer and a small hemorrhoid. And he said, isn't that great? You're going to live. I said, I wanted a second opinion. It was like, no, doc, are you sure? I would rather be terminally ill and die and be right and them wrong than be alive and free. And if you identify with that at all, you do not have a high mental health quotient. But that's the kind of self-delusion that this disease had taken me to. That's the kind of bizarre, dark fantasies I started having at the end. One of my fantasies was, I want to get a job with the mob. I'll be a hitman. Well, my hands shake. I mean, I I'm not going to be a hit. Nobody's going to hire me for it. They won't even hire me to shovel snow. I mean, they're nothing, man. And I'm a basket case. Well, that next year, I was sentenced to 2 years in the state penitentiary in Pennsylvania, and I was placed into a place called the Ark House. It's not a fancy place. It's really the bottom of the food chain for recovery. They handle about 200 guys out of prison and off the streets, homeless guys. And I lived there for quite some time. I was supposed to live there a year and get good UAs and a good PO report and make the restitution. If I did that, it was a misdemeanor time served. If not, it was 2 years. He sentenced me and stayed the commitment. He said it was 2 years automatic. And I went in there and I realized, I tell you something, I tried. And I'd been trying because all the fun's been wrung out of my drinking. And I'm in this horrible phase of alcoholism where I get sober and I'm so demoralized and I'm swearing to myself. And I mean it, that I'm never going to touch that stuff again. But I always go back to it eventually. And I can't stop that. And it doesn't matter what's at stake. You hang prison over me. All it's maybe is going to delay the inevitable. But it doesn't stop it. If you have alcoholism and you're not working the steps and have a sponsor and helping people and buying the whole package of AA, I think the question for the chronic alcoholic is not if you're going to drink again. I think the real question is when. It's inevitability. And so this doctor, he told me, I come to in the park and I got 2 years coming at me. And Clint, my sponsor talks about getting to a place where there's no friendly direction. Like there's nobody that cares about you anymore. There's nobody to call. There's not even any hope in the bottle, in the bag anymore. Because by this time, I've been down all kinds of medications, all kinds of drugs. I've tried all kinds of therapy. I primal screamed. I was in therapy with Albert Ellis, who was a legend. I was in therapy, you know, with Dr. Silverman. I had transactional analysis. I primal screamed in an office one time. I was hypnotized. It didn't keep me sober, but to this day, I don't feel like barking when the doorbell rings. No, that's not true. That's funny, but it's not true. But I tried everything. If it came up on the radar and looked like it might work or help me, I took a run at it. I'm desperate here. And everything had failed. Best I ever got out of all of that was occasionally I'd have something happen to me that would change my life for 2 weeks. But I was always back to being me again. And that ain't no good. Because I ain't right. And I got a big secret, and the big secret is without something, I'm nothing. And I always knew that, and I always hated that about me. But that's the truth. And that doctor who gave me that physical that prior year, he said, kid, you don't have cancer. He said, you got alcoholism. And you keep drinking, and it's going to kill you. But you're a young kid in your 20s. You bounce back physically pretty quick. He said, it might take 5 more years. And I came to in that park and I got in that place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. There's a hopelessness. There is no hope anywhere in any shape or form. And I've tried everything. And I remember that doctor said 5 more years and something inside me snapped and I made the decision to kill myself. And in the decision, I actually felt a little better, like I'm going to get this crap over with. And I'm going to get some closure on all this. And I went to a bridge to kill myself. And I just a couple of weeks, 2 months ago, I was back in Pittsburgh. And they painted all those bridges and this stuff. But I know where the bridge, I went, I think I found the right bridge. But I was standing on that bridge and I'm looking down below me to these railroad tracks along the side of the river. And this terror gripped me. And it's not a fear of dying. Really and truly, it is not. The fear that gripped me is that this isn't high enough and I won't die. With my luck, I'll end up paralyzed from the neck down, I'll lay on a charity ward for 50 years and nobody will bring me a drink as my head plays the movies of everything I'm ashamed of and I can't even kill myself. That terrified me. If there had been a plaque on that bridge and the plaque said, 100% of people who jump from here are dead. You have a different guy up here tonight. But that fear of hurting, getting hurt and being paralyzed just crippled me. And I broke down on that bridge. I started sobbing. I've never felt so pathetic in my life. And I've known some pathetic states. But this is after all of this, and I can't even kill myself. Little did I know that through a bizarre series of coincidences and circumstances, I would end up in a place I never planned to end up, in a detox in Las Vegas, Nevada. If you'd have given me in one of the rehabs in Pennsylvania an opportunity to make a list of 100 cities you might get sober in, Vegas isn't on that list. And I wasn't trying to go to Vegas. I was trying to go to California where I could survive the next winter on the streets. But I made it to Las Vegas, and the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And I sat in that detox, and my first sponsor, who was a a five percenter. He was one of those guys. If there was something in AA that needed help, he was there. He'd been a past delegate. He'd been in every branch of service, every position in intergroup. He was one of the founders of the Las Vegas Roundup, the Las Vegas Retreat, the Samaritan Recovery, Men's Recovery House, the TI. He was on the board of the TIE Club. I met him because he brought meetings twice a week into the detox. They said, I heard a trustee in my first general service area conference say that he thought 5% of the fellowship did 95% of the service in 12-step work. And I don't know if that statistic's true, but if it is, he's one of those 5%. And then the guy said, those 5%ers, as long as they remain a 5%er, they never drink again. And I try to do that. I've watched a dance of death in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years. I've seen some really, really nice people commit suicide with many, many years of sobriety or drink again. There was a woman in Vegas, Debbie. And when I got sober in 78, Debbie was sober a while. And she truly was one of the pillars. She was one of the women. If you say to somebody, who's one of the strongest female members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas? Debbie and this other gal, Nancy, that was it. Those two gals. And Debbie helped me a lot, man. She helped me. And at 43 and a half years of sobriety, Debbie put a pistol in her head and blew her brains out. It was alcoholism. And you don't go from being a pillar of sobriety, a person who's in the trenches in action, you know, 24/7. You don't go from that person to a person blowing your brains out overnight. I think it's a slow, incremental, seductive shift into self-interest. And anything that has you can attach the word my to is self-interest. My house, my job, my business. Believe me, I know I went down that road in sobriety. And I've been very, very fortunate. I've made a lot of mistakes since I've been here. But I never quit doing what they told me to do when I was new. I never grew above it. I never grew to the other side of it. I never grew more important to do it. I've always continued to do it. And I'll tell you what I've discovered. Carl Jung, in a letter to Bill Wilson, talks about something he believed as a result of working with Roland Hazard and countless other alcoholics, that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol wasn't really a thirst for alcohol. Jung said he thought it was a low-level thirst of the alcoholic's being. For wholeness, unity, or as if you're more religious, you might think of it as a union with God. And in early sobriety, as a result of following the actions of that my sponsor suggested, the obsession to drink alcohol was removed, but the thirst never left. It just did shift changing into other stuff. And everything that it shift changed in had the word my attached to it. And this insurgence of self-interest and self-seeking is frightening because if you're like me, you don't know what's happening. I know that Debbie didn't know it. You know, when Debbie committed suicide, she had everything. I mean, she had a lot of money. She had everything you'd ever want. My friend Mike, when he shot himself in the head for the second time, because the first time didn't kill him, and he killed himself on the second shot in the head. Mike had three kids that adored him. Mike had a wife that loved him. He had a big time business, man. He had two businesses, actually. He was partners in this huge Harley-Davidson dealership. They say they build it as the largest in the world. I don't know if it is. And he had a construction company. Mike had everything. Mike was a poster kid for Alcoholics Anonymous. He had everything out here. And he served himself out here. but he stopped doing the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. His little stint with having a sponsor wore off, and they became golf buddies. And I know this because I went down this road. You know what happens when you're going down this road? You don't know you're going down this road. But, you know, I went through a period where I got the entitlement back again, and I got the self-seeking back again in my life. My primary purpose was no longer helping God's kids and doing 12-step work. My primary purpose slowly had become me. And I didn't know it. You know, and I had a sponsor. And I, you know, after I went through something, I would call him up to tell him how I handled it because I thought he might need that information someday. I sponsored guys because my ego demands the bragging rights of being a good AA member without actually being all in. All my chips were no longer in the pot. They were when I was new. And slowly over the years, I started taking them back because I got scared. I stopped trusting God. I stopped believing that He was going to take care of me. And I started taking credit for the things in my life as if I had done them. Now, I wouldn't say that out loud because my ego is very clever. It wants the bragging right. It wants to run the universe and look humble doing it. It's an art form. I'm telling you, it's an art form. And I suffered for a while. I was 19 years sober, and I went back into depression again. It was bad. And a guy in AA told me the truth. And he said, the problem is your primary purpose is no longer serving God and helping His kids. You've undone the decision in step 3. He said, your primary purpose is you. And it snapped me. And I filled my car up with new guys, and I started getting more commitments. And I started putting my chips back in the pot. You know, in the beginning of or in part of the beginning part of fifth chapter, it talks about who makes it and who doesn't. And this is not just new people. This is people 30, 40, 50 years sober. We had a guy on our detox that drank after 45 years. Bill Wilson had been his sponsor. It can happen to anybody. And it says, those who do not recover, or you could almost say, and those who do not stay in recovery, are people who cannot or will not completely, which completely is like a lot. I mean, it's like, completely is not a word of convenience. Completely give themselves to this simple program. And I'd become that guy. And I don't know it. I don't know it. And I created the stage character that it talks about in Into Action. When Wilson says, more than most, the alcoholic lives a double life. I got my Mr. Spiritual, and then I got who I really am. And you can die in the abyss between those two points. If there's a hell on earth, I think it exists in the abyss between genuineness and the facade. And I'll tell you, that was a painful, painful time in my life. And I had him read that part of the book. You know, for my first over 20 years, I'm not even sure when I started following the directions in the book with step 11. And you know, here's the problem. You know, I was a child of the late 60s and 70s, and we did a lot of meditation. We did visualizations. I did Raja Yoga and moved my chakras around. I was in Divine Light Mission. I chanted Anam-myoho Renge Kyo with the Buddhists. I mean, I did Course in Miracles. I mean, I did all this really cool stuff. And you read the book, and the book doesn't look like meditation. Matter of fact, the first direction it gives you is like inventory. I thought, well, that's not even right. That's step 10. No, it's actually step 11. Because Bill in the 12 steps and 12 traditions says that self-examination, the first paragraph on page 86, meditation and prayer, when taken separately can bring about much benefit and relief. But I don't need relief. I've been a relief junkie all my life. You know, when you get relief, you know what you need? You need more relief. But he says when they're logically related and interwoven, they create an unshakable foundation for life. So I had a sponsee who wanted directions on how to do step 11. I said, well, just do what it says in the book. That's, if your sponsor ever says that or says, just pray about something, what he's really saying is, I have no idea. And I didn't have any, I didn't know what to tell the guy because I'd done so many things from the prayer of St. Francis to, I mean, I did so much different stuff. I had little books I'd read every morning. I did a lot of different things. But I never followed the directions in the book and fancied myself a fundamentalist big book guy. But I never did the 11th step out of the book until this guy I sponsor started doing it out of the book. And in no time at all, he seemed to be doing better than I was. And I don't like that much. So I thought, as we, you know, monkey see, monkey do here. You know what I mean? So I see he was doing pretty good doing it. And I thought, I should do that. And what I discovered is it's not a self-serving, selfish meditation, the kind I grew up with, that are designed to make me feel better and me do better. It's not that. It's to make me more of a servant, more useful. I'll tell you, there's a question I ask myself every night. And it shines a light on how far off the beam I am when I ask myself, was I kind and loving towards all? I'm pretty good at being kind and loving to the people who deserve it. But all? Boy, that just shines a light on the return of my ego. And what it does the best and the most, it judges. It plays God. And one of the things it says in there, and I think I love this. This really tells you the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the 11th step, it says we pray only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. I don't pray for anything else. I'll tell God what to do. I mean, you know, when I was a kid in school, I was in grade school. I was a precocious kid. And I found the F word, right? I didn't even know what it meant, except that it had power to make the nun's face turn red. I mean, it was like abracadabra. You could affect the external reality with a word. It was like magical. I mean, negatively magical, but I'd say it. Well, they called me into the office, and they said, you keep doing that, you're going to go to hell. You're breaking the second commandment. The second commandment is that thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Well, I don't swear in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not because of that. I wouldn't want, my God, I wouldn't want anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous to, because of your background or your way or anything, to be offended by something I would say. And if I ever did say something like that, I'd be the first to tell you I was wrong and want to apologize for it. Because I have said some things that I thought were funny that hurt someone's feelings. And I don't want to offend anyone. That's why I really try not to use any profanity in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the vainest, most egocentric use of God's name would be to pray for my will. I mean, when you think about it objectively, here's the creator of the universe who's been doing well for billions of years, but Bob's here now, right? And to instruct God? Is there any vanity greater than that? And, you know, of all the prayers that I've learned since I got sober, the one that has affected me the most, and I say it quietly to myself, because I don't try to turn anybody else. I don't try to inflict it on anybody else. It's actually a pre-Christian version of the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer actually came from Judaism. And if you go back into one of the pre-Christian versions of it, in the second half of the Lord's Prayer, it's just a minor little difference that changes the whole game. And it lines up with the word only in step 11. And I got this from my dear, dear friend Mildred, who's a tremendous scholar. And in this version, the pre-Christian version, it says, Our Father, who art in heaven. In Hebrew, the word for God has pictures associated. It's a visual language, and one of the pictures of God is the picture of a father coming home from work, and his son who trusts and loves him is standing up on the porch about this high. And when he sees his father come closer, he flings himself into his father's arms. And it translates as the father that will never let you fall. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And then it says, you give us this day our daily bread, don't you? Almost as if it's a recognition of the gift that's already given. I used to hear Chuck Chamberlain talk about that. He said, you don't have to ask God for nothing. He's already given it to you. You're just not awake to it. You give us this day our daily bread. You forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And you lead us not into temptation, but you deliver us from evil. And with that little adjustment, man, that prayer lines up with the only in step 11. And I just say that quietly. When we say the Lord's Prayer, I don't say it loud. I'm not trying to impress anybody with it. It's just my deal because I like that. And I just quietly say, you give us this day. Because I don't want to tell God what to do. God's been really good to me. It took me, I bet, over maybe close to 25 years or more before I realized that this was starting to take. You know, I talked a pretty good game for a long time about trusting God. But when push came to shove and I was afraid, not so much. And it took a while for me to really get to a place where I knew, my innermost self, I know that God's got my back. That God loves me and He will be there. He's the Father that will never let me fall. Wilson says something in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. He says that we talk a lot about problems. And then he goes on to say why. He says, well, it's because we are problem people. We are. My head is a problem-seeking missile. What it does best is threat assessments. You know, Jerry, I don't know if I'm sure I'm not the only one that spends a lot of time in their life trying to solve problems that haven't occurred yet. Right? And if they do occur, it's because you got in there and monkeyed with them and made it happen. You know, that self-fulfilling prophecies that it talks about in the fear inventory. What if it's all wired? What if God really and truly, and He is the creator of the universe, wants me and has set things in motion so that I will be happy, joyous, and free? What if there is no problems in my life? They're just the delusional imaginings of an ego that's scared that if it has no problems to monkey with, it will recede into obscurity. My ego's got to have problems to solve. It has to have something to play God over. But what if those problems never did exist? What if Dr. Paul said was right, when he would be out helping God's kids, he was amazed that his problems would die of neglect? How many times? One of the great steads in my sobriety has been these detox meetings. And I'll tell you something. I've gone into those detox meetings sometimes where it's like I feel walking in like Chicken Little and the sky's falling and I'm going to lose everything. My business is great. And I'll come out. And while I'm in there, the problem had been solved without me. It's kind of an insult, really. I mean, It's just it's like life is self-correcting. What if there never really was problems? What if we never left the Garden of Eden? We just think we have because we're scared. What if I just go through my life imagining all these problems that don't exist just to serve an ego that has to have them to be dominant? I heard this story years ago, and Scott could probably shed more light on it because he's a pilot. But a guy that told me he was a pilot, and he told me this story about flying a small plane. I don't remember the type of plane, but he got up into pretty high in the plane, I guess, and hit a wind shear, and it threw him into a tailspin. And he said it was frightening. You think you're going to die. You're spinning out of control. And he said every instinct in him was to pull back on that stuff. And he said he learned that if he pulled back on it, he would crash and die for sure. What he had to do was something that was against his emotions. That this plane was designed by its creator, and maybe my life was too, so that if you just push this thing forward and let it snap back on its own, that it corrects itself. What if my life is like that, and all I got to do is let go and trust God? And everyone in the universe seems to have known that except me. And so that's the battle right there between this head that wants to scare me. You know, Wilson talks about one of the key things that blocks me from this God deep down within me. He calls it calamity. It's the chatter. It's that voice in my head that just whispers. Do you ever notice that the voice in your head is seductive and much more reasonable than your sponsors? It says good things to you. It says you don't need to pay all your taxes. The government does horrible things. It says you don't need to listen to your sponsor. He's old. It says, you know, they want you to stay away from the new girl. They probably want her for themselves. You know, it just says all. It says you need to stand up for yourself and don't take that. Quit that job. Tell that boss off. Somebody needs to tell him. It says all that stuff. I have quit jobs based on imagined problems and based on what I thought they were thinking in my early sobriety. I was early, in Genesis, in the Old Testament story of Adam and Eve, when they introduced the serpent into the Garden of Eden, if you were to actually go back to the Hebrew, the word that they use is not the word for serpent. It's the word for the sound the serpent makes. It's this. Talks to you. It's a nice voice. It's a reasonable voice. This voice really understands. This voice is me. I was early sobriety. I was having a nervous breakdown from solving problems that haven't occurred yet. You know, just, do you ever get crazy? Just like you can't do. And I'm imploding into a depression. And I tell this old timer about all these things. It's just, oh my God, it's this and this and this, this and this and this. And he says, oh, he said, you think that you are your mind, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, you think you're your head. I said, well, yeah, it's my mind, my head. He said, that's not you. No. No, you're the idiot that keeps listening to it. If you're new here, surrender yourself to Alcoholics Anonymous. Make this the center of your life. Take a position where your life is no longer your own. My life is not my own, and it's beautiful as a result of that. I have people say to me, "What? How can you do? How do you do all this stuff? You got these detox, all these commitments, all this stuff. How do you travel all the time? You can't play music. You can't have a relationship really of any value because nobody wants to have a guy gone all the time." You know, all I can say is that when I got saved from the alcoholic pit, I told God, I'll do anything you want me to do. And if you'll just take care of me. And he's lived up to his part of it. And I try to live up to mine. Thanks for listening.